Okay, let's get back to our regular Monday night wrap-up of the current status of the coronavirus catastrophe. And if for no other reason than the economic damage, think about it, the economic damage, political damage, social damage, medical damage we know about, but there have been so many other things that will never recover. At least I can't imagine it happening. Here are a few headlines for you. Mario, Governor Cuomo and other governors are mum after the CDC suddenly drops its two-week quarantine on travelers into certain states. So that's been dropped. Colorado governor says people should expect coronavirus school closures just as in-person classroom learning resumes. That's what Henry's been saying for a long time. Another attack on food. I term this a fear attack. Live coronavirus found on meat and seafood weeks later, say researchers. Well, I haven't read the story, so I won't comment anymore. An Oxford professor says people are overly frightened of coronavirus. Florida judge halts order requiring schools to reopen for in-person instruction. As more children learn from home, the state is cracking down on virtual truancy. So if you miss your home video lesson, you kids are in trouble. The World Health Organization chief warns against vaccine nationalism as 172 countries sign up for global COVID vaccine distribution. And our first cruise line has gone under. It's a small one. Coronavirus claims its first U.S.-based cruise line. And here's one for Henry. Almost 50 North Texas residents drank bleach this month. And the Poison Control Center warns, stop it. It won't cure the coronavirus. 50. That has to hang on President Trump's collar. Hello, Henry. Welcome back.
Hi, Jeff. It's good to be back. There were quite a few developments over the weekend in addition to the ones you just cited. And I thought I'd go through a few of those, a little bit of a change of pace. And so just going through some of the numbers on the states, although there is a new website, actually I don't have it right in front of me, that that actually is going to be mapping the cases in schools in the U.S. And that they've got them in a couple different categories. Some are just third parties call them in, and the others are confirmed. But
Excuse me. Yeah. Are you by any chance on speakerphone? Your audio sounds different. It's distant. If you're on
okay,
a speaker,
okay. How's this out? Is this better?
Not much. Are you on the handset?
Hold on. Let me switch over. Is this better?
Sounds about the same.
Is this better now?
Yeah, I think we're getting there. Say something.
Hello. Sorry.
Well, that's a good
start. Can you
hear
me now?
Yeah, we hear you. You have a good radio voice, but it sounded real distant and tinny for some reason, like you were on a speakerphone that wasn't the greatest. I don't know. But anyhow, I just want you to sound your best. I hear ambient noises.
Hello?
In the background, too. Go ahead. Say anything. We may have lost him. I think we did. There's some. I don't know what's different, but you heard him try to change whatever it was. And it didn't improve it. The very end, it sounded, the last, whatever it was. Some people will get on a speakerphone and they think it's okay, but it's real evident that it's not. We got to get right on that mouthpiece. Okay. 50 North Texans actually drank bleach this month. This went into the Poison Control Center. 50. That's a lot of people. I wonder how many in other states drank bleach during the month to cure them or prevent infections. Who knows what they were thinking? That's a lot of people, though. That's just North Texas. All right, Henry, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. Just better.
No, there's the old Henry. All right, you sound like yourself now.
Okay. As far as the bleach is concerned, I think there's a lot more than just 50 in North Texas. This has been going on ever since Trump talked about it. And it just takes, there were poison control reports in multiple states when he said that. And, the more virus there is, the more people that think that, that'll work or something. I don't know.
I don't know either, but not good.
But, it's not a good situation, and probably not going to get better because the virus isn't really going to get under control. I said I wanted to go through a couple stories. I did look at the one you mentioned on Friday about lab generated virus, and I did take a look at that one. I don't know. It's some guy who wrote a book or something. It's only available in Italian, and it really it's just nonsense. At least the report. Maybe something got lost in the translation. But the link you had was kind of an English summary of it, and it really was the old HIV insert story. Just as a brief reminder, this is a report that came out. Things were set up so that scientists could get things out to the public before they were peer reviewed, and so there's a website that basically post manuscripts prior to submission and peer review. And the idea was you get the information out quickly. Most of what was published there was on SARS-CoV-2 or something related to that. And this was a group out of India that had taken a look at the sequences. The sequences had just been released. So this was back in either late January, early February. And they basically saw sequences that when they looked at gene bank, they matched HIV, and they cited that as evidence of manipulation of the sequence and inserting HIV sequences. And when I saw that paper, just the title made me think that they probably just used very short sequences and found matches in the database, which was something I had done 17 years ago with SARS-1. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing, that basically you take a very short sequence and look into the database, you're likely to get chance matches by whatever's highly represented in the database. And even 17 years ago, one of the primary sets of sequences that was in gene bank were HIV sequences. So I could find HIV matches. I was looking at individual polymorphisms in SARS-1 to get an idea where they were coming from. Right. And I got match after match was with HIV. So I knew that these guys had done exactly the same thing, that the match they had was very short. And there's still a lot of HIV sequences. Of course, there's more than ever. And several others noted that there was nothing unusual about the SARS-CoV-2 sequence, that these weren't HIV sequences. There was nothing unusual about inserts. That happens all the time with coronaviruses. And the group immediately retracted the paper. So the paper got retracted after about 1 day. But even though it had been retracted, and even though people that work on sequences and do these types of searches and are well aware that if it's a very short sequence, you're going to get matches that, you know, might have something to do with the evolution of viruses that goes back thousands of years. But it really has nothing to do with the current evolution or anything to do with inserts that were put in there. So it was pretty well discounted, and you know, it, literally within 24 hours after it was published, it's a paper that would have never passed peer review because too many people are aware of this type of artifact, and it wouldn't have been published. However, since it was published, there are all
off,
of these people
the
that
races.
Know nothing about sequences, but are very big on man-made viruses, especially when they heard it's a novel coronavirus. So they assume if it's novel, it's man-made, and the fact that it was in China, there was man, you know, it's at the Wuhan Institute, blah, blah, blah. It's all nonsense. But the paper, the report that you cited was even more ridiculous, because not only was it talking about the HIV insert still, which most people aren't still talking about, it says something about a matrix virus. I have no idea what they were talking about with respect to that. I don't think they do either, because
I didn't read it. I'm glad
with,
you did.
With the virus. But on top of that, they said that the sequence that China released wasn't the complete sequence, that they had this other sequence that they were working on, and that they released a sequence that wasn't complete, and therefore vaccines made against the release sequence by China would not recognize the real sequence that had been the source of all the cases. But that's an absurd statement, because I had mentioned last week that there were 82,000 sequences that were now available. It's actually 85,000 now, a little over 85,000, almost 86,000. And new sequences come out every day, about 300 or so come out every day. And they come out from labs worldwide. They come out from countries worldwide. And all of the sequences that come out and are available at clinical samples. So these are from people that are infected with the virus, and this is the sequence of the virus that's infected them. So the idea that there's a sequence out there that China made that is causing all the illness is crazy, and that's another reason that the whole bioweapon idea is crazy, because everybody gets to see your work. That if you go and you make a bioweapon and you release it and it causes a worldwide pandemic, that everybody in the world gets a chance to see what that sequence is. And they can figure out where it came from, and they can figure out how it was manipulated. And so there's literally 86,000 sequences from countries, you know, 200 countries in the world, and labs, multiple labs in most of the countries, or many of the more advanced countries. And they all essentially have the same sequence. They've got the same, you know, novel SARS-CoV-2 sequence. It's got a few changes here and a few changes there, but basically they're all the same sequence that China released back in January. So everybody knew what the sequence was in January, and everybody's seen that sequence confirmed literally tens of thousands of times. And this guy's coming out with a paper Friday saying that there's a mystery sequence out there making vaccines against the sequence that China released isn't going to work. against the virus is causing the disease and ignores the fact that everybody in the world knows what virus is causing the disease. And they've sequenced it 86,000 times now. And they all know what that sequence is. They know what the basic sequence is. Hmm. And they know what changes there are in each of the 86,000 sequences. So the paper was absurd on every level. And as soon as you said, oh, there's somebody new, you know, there's a new paper about out showing, proving that the virus was man-made, you know, it was...
I don't even remember that. I know I didn't read it.
It was just a matter of what they were, what nonsense story is.
Well,
it's the latest, and it isn't even a new story. It's the original story that came out with the HIV
insert. They rehashed it. I see.
Right. Except they made it more, except they tried to make it more exotic by saying there were two different sequences. And the sequences that are causing the disease is not the sequence that they're making the vaccines against. And it's just not true because everybody's got those sequences. And then I said there were different versions of it and the vaccine wouldn't work. Well, number one, most of the vaccines are against the spike protein. And number two, most of the mutations that have been identified do not change the spike protein. So the spike protein, there's a difference in the spike protein for the Italian strain, and it's one position, and that one position change is well known. But a lot of the additional mutations that have been identified are either silent, they don't change the protein, or they're in one of the other genes that's not in the vaccine. So anyway, that's a quick rundown of that story. But now to get to a story that's relevant to this universe, not some parallel universe that's got all these mystery viruses that don't exist. Over the weekend, actually it was yesterday at 6 o'clock, Trump called a news conference for a major announcement. And the major announcement was
plasma.
Give approval to convalescent antibodies. And that announcement, or even before he made the announcement, the remarks about what the announcement was going to be on raised some serious concern, because before he made the announcement of this, you know, wider use of this particular technique, he said that the FDA was slow walking the approvals, and it was part of the deep state because they were going to hold off on approvals until after the election. And it was claim that didn't make any sense, because the FDA basically reviews what's put forward by individual companies. Individual companies basically do the tests, they get the data, they say why a drug should be approved, and they submit that after they've run a clinical trial. And the company is who determines how quickly that's going to go, based upon how quickly they can recruit people, run the tests, get the data, and analyze the data and come to the conclusion that the data supports their new treatment or new drug or whatever. And so the FDA doesn't have anything to do with the recruitment. That's done by the manufacturer of the product that they're seeking FDA approval. FDA just reviews the data that's submitted by the company. So Trump is blaming the FDA for this. What he's saying is a slow pace approvals, and the FDA doesn't have anything to do with that. The FDA basically reviews the data when it's submitted to them. They don't basically recruit patients for a given trial. So that didn't make any sense. And then when he first tweets out that there's this delay and it's the deep state, none of which made any sense. And then within 24 hours, he comes out and say, oh, I got an announcement to make that we're going to go ahead and expand it. It's basically indicating that he's strong-arming the FDA. So the FDA is designed to make sure that the products meet their requirements and basically show safety and efficacy before it's released to the public to protect the public. And Trump is basically saying, oh, we don't need to do that. We need to get something out there because the convention starts in less than 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And we need to get an approval so I can make a 6 p.m. Sunday night announcement. And so when he made the announcement, the word that he was going to be making that announcement did not sound very promising. It sounded like he was basically taking over the FDA now. And when they made the announcement, it was even more absurd because just as a review, convalescent antibodies are antibodies in the blood of people that have basically been infected with a virus, usually. And they made antibodies to the virus, and then they basically get blood from the people that have recovered, and all they need to do is spin out their red blood cells and have the liquid, which is the plasma, or plasma, as Trump calls it.
But he called plasma, it plasma.
Plasma, yeah, it's mm-hmm. plasma.
And, well, that's similar to plasma, I guess. It's a similar product from blood.
He was consistently plasma. But anyway, the plasma is easy to make. I mean, all you got to do is have a centrifuge, and the red blood cells go to the bottom of the tube, and you take the liquid in the top of the tube, you know, above the pellet at the bottom.
Right.
And that's a technology that's been around for over 100 years. Okay, so it's not a new technology, and is not new to, you know, COVID. It's in fact it was used against the Ebola outbreak not that many years ago, and it didn't really work that well for the Ebola outbreak, and there was questions as to how well it works against COVID. Mm-hmm. And so just to give a little background on what the data is, the data that's out there, the Mayo Clinic received funding from the government to take a look at how patients were doing who received convalescent antibodies. And the convalescent antibodies were being used kind of on a compassionate use basis, so that essentially they were being used fairly widely. And, you know, you had mentioned that the Red Cross was advertising that, you know, we'll let you know about whether you've got antibodies if you donate blood, because they were looking for blood that has antibodies to COVID. Because different clinicians were using the convalescent anastera is a compassionate use. So it was already fairly widely available. And the fact that it was fairly widely available did impact the ability to do clinical trials. Because if you sign up for a clinical trial, there's a 50-50 chance you'll end up with a placebo. Whereas if you say, I don't want to sign up for a clinical trial, I want to on compassionate use so I get the antibody. And so it's been difficult to get a completed clinical trial, but it wasn't because of the FDA. In part it was because they were using it as compassionate use, which Trump apparently didn't know about, or if he knew about it, he didn't understand what he was supposed to know because he'd already been told about it. Because he said, well, can't we do that, at this press conference when that's what they've been doing all along, and that's where all the data came from the Mayo Clinic. But the Mayo Clinic data analysis was not a clinical trial. It wasn't set up so that, half the people get a placebo and half of the people get the convalescent Anacera, and then you see whether there's a difference in whether the convalescent Anacera is really working. What they did is they took all the data and they tried to figure out a way to see whether there was a benefit for the convalescent Anacera. And one of the ways they did it was how early you got the treatment. Mm-hmm. And so they basically took the patients that got treated within 3 days of symptoms and those that were treated 4 or more days from the symptom.
Right.
And they saw a difference. And they found out that if you got treated quicker, you did better. Now, most people know that if you've got an infectious disease and people go to the hospital so that they can be treated, sometimes it's just palliative, but it's treatment that, if you can't breathe and they give you oxygen, that might help you recover. And if they basically put you on a ventilator, that might help you recover. And various treatments that they basically give you when you're in the hospital where you've got, hooked up to monitors and theoretically being mm-hmm. watched if there aren't too many people, that all of those things are designed to have a positive outcome. They don't always get a positive outcome, but that's what the treatments are designed to do. So if you get into the hospital earlier and you start getting treatments, and it's not just a convalescent antibody, they'll give you supplemental oxygen, they'll basically monitor you, they'll figure out what they can do to help the situation, and they'll
How is supplemental oxygen delivered, Henry, vis-a-vis people think about, being put on a vent? How is supplemental? Is that just like a nostril kind of double tube?
Yeah.
Right.
It's just giving you oxygen. And they tried just oxygenating it by giving you oxygen. And then if that's not really doing the trick, then they go to ventilators where it's more like a, or an ECMO machine. And so it's a more aggressive approach. It doesn't necessarily always work because if you get to the level where you need a ventilator, sometimes your lungs are in such bad shape that they don't really mm-hmm. do all that much better. Right. And so the point is that if they see a benefit for the people that get in three days or less after disease onset, it doesn't mean that benefit is solely or even partially due to the convalescent Anacera, because they do whatever they can to help you. They don't do this one thing and say that's it and good luck. They'll do whatever. They'll give you oxygen. There's a bunch of different procedures that they're going to do to try to mitigate the problem. And usually the major problem is that there's breathing difficulties. So the fact that they see 3 days is better than 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, I mean, there's no upper limit. They're comparing people that got in the hospital within a couple of days of symptoms versus those who stayed at home for a couple of weeks and they were really in bad shape by the time they finally decided to go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, you know, the people that came in 2 days after symptoms did better than the ones that waited 2 weeks. And you say, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. wow, mm-hmm. what a surprise. So that's the data. That's what saying the antibody works, is comparing people that got in there 1, 2, or 3 days after symptoms versus people that got in there 4 days or more. They might have waited 2 weeks uh-huh. to go to the uh-huh. hospital. So the fact that the ones that got in there quicker did better than the ones that got in there later doesn't mean that they did better because they got the antibody. They just got treatment quicker. Yeah, I know it's of course. That's the data. That's what they want to go ahead and make this more widely available, because that's the data that says it works. And that's the data they used that said they got a 35% reduction in mortality. Mm-hmm. It's nonsense. And it's not only nonsense because they're comparing two completely different groups, 3 days versus 4 or more. They also did another one that said, well, if you got a higher titer of antibody, you seem to have done better than if you had a lower titer. But again, they don't really know what's going on there. They're just trying to break it down into two categories and say higher works better than lower. But they right. don't know why the lower didn't work as well. I mean, for all they know, people that had a lower titer had a lower titer because they were making antibodies that basically were enhancing antibodies that basically make the virus spread more easily. So that if they're comparing low titer versus high titer, might not be because there's more good antibodies. It could be that there's more bad antibodies in the low titer, and that the high titer did better because they didn't get the low antibody group, which is a negative. So they really don't have a whole lot of data. And Mayo Clinic said that more studies are needed. So Mayo Clinic, who looked at the data, said this is, you know, if you look at this, this is an indication maybe it's working. You know, if you were there 3 days after symptoms, you did better than if you were there 6 days after symptoms. And if you got the higher titer, you seem to do better than the lower titer. But on top of that, well, you know, it kind of looks this way. We really need to do a clinical trial to know if it works, is essentially what they're saying. So there's no clinical trial. And on top of that, this improvement isn't anybody. They put limitations on who they could see the improvement with. And the limitations were that you had to be under the age of 80. So the people that need it the most mm-hmm. are older. And it doesn't apply to them because it doesn't work for them. So A, you got to be younger than 80. And B, you have to have not been on a ventilator. So that if you go on,
it's a jungle out there. Wow.
Or if you go on a ventilator, it doesn't work. It only works for the people that really don't need it. that are mostly going to do better because they never have to go on a ventilator. So the people that don't need to go on a ventilator do better mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. than the people that do. And that what the people they're trying this because it's a Hail Mary. They basically are trying an approach that they have no definitive data that it works. They just conceptually it might work. The idea is that if you give them antibodies, that's good. And that's all they've got to go on. And they've got a couple hints that maybe it's working. So the recommendation was that they need more data before they could go ahead and make this even more widely available. And they've got a limitation anyway, because the convalescent antibodies aren't something that you're making in the lab. It's not something that you've got an unlimited supply. You have to get the antibodies from people who have recovered. Right. And then, based upon what they're looking for, it's got to be high titer antibodies. If it's low titer antibodies, it doesn't work then. So part of the convalescence era, there's no data that it works. It basically looks like it doesn't work. And then the other part is you got a limited population that's even going to benefit it from. And then the other problem is you don't have a clinical trial. And then to complicate things even further, that by holding a press conference and saying, oh, we got a 30% reduction in mortality, this is a major breakthrough, then you're not going to get anybody to sign up for the trial, and you're never going to know if it works. So that's what Trump managed to do. And then he got Hahn, the head of the FDA, to kind of field some of the questions, and they kind of asked him, well, does it really work? And he didn't say yes. He says, well, we've got this data, and it looks encouraging, and, we think that, people will benefit from this, and more research needs to be done. And this isn't an approval. This is just, making it more widely available. So it approves it for use under certain circumstances, but it's not like this is an FDA-approved drug. This is a limited use type of wider availability, which it sounded like it was already readily available. The doctors could ask for this on a compassionate use. And that's how Mayo Clinic had all this data, because they are using it. But what they're trying to figure out is whether it's doing anything useful. So right. The announcement Sunday night was bad, because it was clear that the FDA caved to Trump, Dr. Trump, who's saying, you got to do this, you got to make this more widely available.
Right.
And in contradiction with the advice of other scientists, who says, well, we don't really have enough data yet. We need to get more data. Nobody said you shouldn't use it, period. They just said that you need to do a clinical trial to find out if the fact that the people that took it 3 days after symptoms or less did better than the ones that did 4 days or more, because the antibody works, as opposed to they just got in the hospital quicker. So that's where...
Let me kind of bring this home. That was a long expose. How dangerous is this for him to be doing that?
Well, like I said, they're never going to find out if it works or not, because they're not going to be able to do the clinical trial. So they're going to spend time trying to get people to give blood so they can get antibodies, and they don't know if what they're trying to get is doing anything beneficial the patient. And as far as the danger is concerned, you're taking whole blood from somebody that's recovered from COVID. So there's no telling exactly what's in the blood.
See, you're taking the blood, for our listeners, to get the plasma out of it.
Right. You're spinning out the red cells, and you're giving you're basically transfusing somebody's blood without the red blood cells.
That's what it is.
So it's a liquid.
How much screening do they do before they would inject plasma into somebody else? What are they screening for?
I'm sure they screen for HIV. They probably
Hep C,
do some type of
right.
They probably try to do some type of screening to make sure that there's no active virus still around, COVID mm-hmm. still around. And mm-hmm. they've already used this as an excuse for people to develop test positive well after the fact that, we don't know if this is a real virus or not. But
right.
this is the same thing. Maybe there is some virus in there. And by giving a transfusion, you're given this antibody and you're given the virus and you're still not sure how well the antibody is going to work in this other host. As if they take the time, because I think they have to do a blood match for it. So they have to screen and figure out who's eligible for this one and who's eligible for that one. So they have to figure out who to give it to. And they're, actively trying to get more of it. So they're expending resources on that.
Right.
But the worst part is that they've got Trump telling the FDA to approve this when scientists have already said it's not ready for approval. And the bigger concern is that now that he's already done this and gotten the FDA to go along with him and reverse themselves, because they had already said mm-hmm. a few days ago that it wasn't ready, and there was no new data between the time they said it wasn't ready and the time they said it was ready, other than Trump tweeting and then complaining and then telling him that, I don't know what he told him, but the bottom line was this was a made for TV approval so that he's got something to say at the Republican convention on this, remarkable achievement that they got convalescent plasma.
Right.
Antibodies more available, and the point is it was already pretty available, and it's not a new technique, and it's still far from clear that it actually works. And the bigger concern is that now that he's got this success with the FDA, that they're going to give in to his demand.
Well, it sounds like it.
Based not on science, just him pounding the table or saying, I'm going to fire you, or whatever his threat was, that he's now going to do this for a vaccine. And he's going to follow Russia's lead, where Russia went and said, we got this vaccine, we're going to make it available, and we've only done a phase one. We haven't even done our phase three trial yet. But we're taking orders. We're open for business. You can get our vaccine. And rumor has it that is Trump's plan. He plans on making the vaccine available before they have virtually any data from the phase three trial. So they really don't know how safe it is, but they haven't expanded. They've only done the initial phase one trial, which is on a limited number of people.
Right.
They don't really know how well it works with a more diverse population. They don't know what kind of side effects it has on a larger population. They don't even know if it's going to end up doing what other coronavirus vaccines do, which is lead to antibody enhancement. So as a result of taking the vaccine, you end up becoming susceptible to a slightly different version of the virus. And there's data now starting to come out that is going to be a concern, which is the other story I want to talk about tonight.
Got 6 minutes.
SARS, this SARS-1 or 2 is paralleling what happened with SARS-1. And when SARS-1 came out, it looks good. It isn't really evolving that quickly. And if we make a vaccine, the vaccine's going to work because we've got an easy target and it really doesn't change much. Well, the point is that the vaccine gets the virus to change. And with SARS, they had a reasonable argument because SARS, there were only something like 7,700 cases in the end that were actually confirmed. So the number of cases was very low. It wasn't a pandemic. It was an epidemic. Mm-hmm. And today, there's a paper coming out. I still haven't seen the paper yet to get the specifics on somebody that's been infected twice by the coronavirus. This is somebody in Hong Kong. They were infected the first time in like March or April. And then they were recently infected after they took a trip to Spain.
So that's 90 days.
They got infected a second time, right?
Approximately.
It's not just the time frame that says it's a second infection. They actually got sequences from both infections. And that's what they've always been missing when they, you know, do this hocus pocus stuff and say, well, I don't know if you really got infected a second time. I think that the virus might have just been hidden away and you tested negative and the virus kind of, you know, the assay is fluctuating. You ended up with a positive and you were just picking up dead virus and it wasn't really a second infection. Well, right. In this case, they had a big time gap and they sequenced it. And there were like 24 differences in the sequence between the first time the person was infected and the second time they were infected. And the first time the virus looked like the virus that was in the UK and the US. So it sounds like it was the Italian strain. And then the second time, it was the virus that's in Spain and the UK, which sounds like it's probably a more evolved Italian strain. And the point isn't that the second time he was identified and tested positive and they got the virus, but he was asymptomatic so that he got some protection from the first one. It's not really clear exactly, you know, why he was asymptomatic, because a lot of people are asymptomatic. But the concern is that it wasn't that long ago that he got infected the first time. He was sicker the first time, so he probably made more antibody initially than he did the second time. And so... the immunity wasn't long-lasting. But the other concern isn't that the immunity wasn't long-lasting. Mm-hmm. It was that the virus is evolving. And so they've got 25 differences between the earlier Italian strain and the current Italian strain. And what that indicates is that that is going to end up causing a problem. So the vaccines haven't even been approved yet. And the vaccine might work well against the original strain. But if you've got a bunch of changes now that they can get evolve away from the antibodies that were made against the initial virus, and if you've got a worldwide pandemic, so you literally have tens of millions of people infected, you've got a lot of virus floating around. And the coronavirus evolves primarily by recombination. And so if you've got a lot of cases, that you have the opportunity for dual infection. So the same person can be infected with two different versions of the virus. And if you have two different versions of the virus in the same person, you can come out with a recombinant that has part of the genetic information from one parent and part from the other.
Yeah, you just opened an interesting door. That's how you come out with recombinants. And they could be more lethal, less lethal, whatever.
they can evade the immune system more easily because they're going to take part of one and part from another.
Yes. Yeah.
And they'll end up not susceptible to the immune mm-hmm. system, mm-hmm. and there'll be selection for those. So that if you've got two parents and a recombinant, and the recombinant has enough from the two parents that it does a better job than either of the parents, that the two parents will get knocked out by the immune system, and the recombinant will survive, and that will become dominant. And so there is a concern that, and then that also applies to these antibody enhancements. So if you end up getting a vaccine against the original virus, and then there's a more evolved virus circulating, that it's possible that the antibodies to the original virus not only won't knock out the more evolved version, but they'll enhance its ability to infect, and the more evolved version will be able to more easily infect somebody who's actually got antibodies to the early version. So those mm-hmm. are the little bits and pieces that says that it can be a very rocky road coming up, and they all kind of complement each other. It's not HIV inserts you have to worry about. It's recombination and evolution, which is ongoing. And
interesting little knock at the end there with the. Explain how recombinants come out of people if they get two different versions. We need to spend more time on that at some point. Okay, very good. Thank you. That was a lot of data, and it was very important. You got it out. Good job.
Okay, sounds good. I'll talk tomorrow. Take care.
Okay, thanks, Henry. All right, there's your update on the recombinant thing. That's something we're going to have to watch. All right. Back with you tomorrow night. Thanks for being here. Have a good day. Take care.